In a world where power flows through the will of many into the hands of the few, one young man's journey through deception, betrayal, and self-discovery becomes the fulcrum upon which an entire civilization may pivot. James Islington's The Will of the Many has captivated readers worldwide since its release, earning praise from fantasy luminaries like Brandon Sanderson, who called it a masterclass in world-building. The novel has consistently appeared on bestseller lists, with readers particularly drawn to its intricate political system and the protagonist's complex moral journey. What makes this book especially resonant in our current cultural moment is its exploration of how systems of inequality perpetuate themselves through the willing participation of those they oppress, a theme that has made it popular among political scientists and social commentators, as well as fantasy enthusiasts. The Catanan Republic operates on a deceptively simple premise: power flows upward. In this meticulously constructed society, a rigid hierarchical system divides citizens into 8 ranks, from the lowly octavus to the supreme princeps. What makes the system unique is the concept of will, a transferable energy that allows those who receive it to perform seemingly miraculous feats, from healing wounds to manipulating physical objects to powering massive vehicles. The transfer of will is not voluntary but institutionalized. At age 12, citizens undergo the Aurora Columni ritual, permanently ceding a portion of their mental and physical energy to those above them. An octavus gives will to no one but receives none, while a princeps receives will from over 40,000 people. This creates a society where the privileged few at the top wield godlike powers, while the masses at the bottom struggle with diminished capacity. This system is justified through the mantra "stronger together," suggesting that pooling resources benefits everyone. Yet, as we follow our protagonist's journey, we see the cruel reality. The system primarily benefits those at the top, while keeping the lower ranks dependent and weakened. The Republic's stability relies on this power imbalance and the complicity of its citizens, who, having undergone the ritual, have little choice but to participate in their own subjugation. What makes this world-building so compelling is how it serves as a metaphor for real-world power structures. The physical manifestation of energy flowing upward makes visible what often remains hidden in our own societies: how systems of privilege extract resources from the many to benefit the few. Through this lens, Islington invites readers to question not just the fictional hierarchy, but the power structures we ourselves participate in and perpetuate. At the heart of this tale is Vis, a young man with a dangerous secret. Working as a guard at Letton's prison, he harbors a truth that would mean his death if discovered. He is actually Diago, the presumed dead prince of conquered Sus, who escaped execution when his family was overthrown by the hierarchy. More dangerously still, he never underwent the Aurora Columnae ritual, making him immune to the will-draining effects of the prison's sappers, devices that incapacitate prisoners by drawing away their will. Vis's life changes dramatically when he's adopted by Quintus Ulcus Cortelimus, a high-ranking military official who recognizes his unique status. Ulciscor doesn't expose Vis, but instead offers him a Faustian bargain: infiltrate the prestigious Catanan Academy as a spy for military interests against religion, or be forced to undergo the Aurora Columnae and sell his will. The academy serves as the perfect microcosm of the larger society. Students advance through 7 classes based on merit, with the highest achievers never needing to cede will to others. Yet beneath this meritocracy veneer lies a web of political maneuvering, as the academy is controlled by religion, one of the 3 major factions, alongside military and governance, vying for power within the Republic. Vis's mission becomes increasingly complex when he discovers that Ulciscor's true motivation is personal. He believes the Academy's principalis, Viridius, murdered his brother Chiror and covered it up. Meanwhile, Vis finds himself caught between multiple factions: military, religion, and the Angus, a rebel group fighting against the hierarchy itself. The brilliance of this setup lies in how it forces Vis to constantly navigate conflicting loyalties. Every relationship becomes a potential weapon or weakness. His growing friendships with fellow students Kalidas, Ivan, and Amisa provide him with much-needed allies, but also vulnerabilities that can be exploited by his enemies. His romantic feelings for Amisa further complicate matters, as he can never be certain of her true allegiance. Through Viss's experiences, Islington explores how systems of oppression force individuals into impossible moral choices. Is it better to work within a corrupt system to change it gradually, or to oppose it directly at great personal risk? Can one maintain personal integrity while playing a role in a game where deception is necessary for survival? The Katanan Academy represents the hierarchy's ideal of meritocracy, a place where talent and hard work supposedly determine one's future. Yet, through Viss's eyes, we see how this promise is undermined by the very structure it claims to transcend. From his first day, Viss encounters the reality that class and connections matter as much as ability. When he defends a lower-ranked student from bullying, he faces punishment despite being in the right. His advancement is repeatedly blocked by Preceptor Doltatis, who bears a grudge against Ulsiscor's family. Meanwhile, less talented students from powerful families progress with ease. The Academy's physical structure mirrors the hierarchy itself. Lower-ranked students live in cramped dormitories with minimal amenities, while higher classes enjoy private rooms with sea views. The dining hall is literally tiered, with the best food and views reserved for the highest classes. Even the curriculum reinforces inequality. Only higher classes learn the most powerful applications of will. Perhaps most revealing is the Academy's admission system. Kalidas explains that intake is precisely calculated based on anticipated high-level openings in the hierarchy. They want to make sure that when we graduate, they can shift people around to more regional pyramids if needed. Make sure that there are enough good positions for all of us. This exposes the fundamental lie. The system isn't designed to reward merit, but to maintain existing power structures while giving the appearance of fairness. The Academy also serves as a battleground for the larger political conflicts within the Republic. Religion controls the curriculum and administration, while military and governance vie for influence through their sponsored students. The mysterious deaths of students in higher classes suggest something even more sinister at work. Through this setting, Islington offers a powerful critique of how educational institutions often reproduce rather than challenge social hierarchies. The Academy doesn't create a level playing field, but instead provides a veneer of legitimacy to a fundamentally unequal system, a reflection that resonates with critiques of elite educational institutions in our own world. Central to both the Academy's training and the novel's symbolism is the labyrinth, a complex maze controlled by will-imbued bracers that allow users to manipulate its walls. Ostensibly a training tool for developing will control, the labyrinth becomes a multifaceted metaphor throughout the narrative. On a practical level, the labyrinth tests students' abilities to navigate complex situations under pressure. One person runs the maze, while another controls its configuration, requiring perfect coordination and communication between partners. Success demands not just individual skill, but trust and cooperation, qualities that become increasingly rare as students advance through the ranks and competition intensifies. Symbolically, the labyrinth represents the political landscape Viss must navigate. Just as the maze's walls shift unpredictably, alliances and enemies change without warning. The student controlling the maze mirrors the unseen powers manipulating events from above. Viss's exceptional skill in the labyrinth foreshadows his growing ability to maneuver through the hierarchy's complex power dynamics. The labyrinth takes on darker significance when Viss discovers its true origins in ancient ruins beneath the Academy. There, he finds glowing writing and diagrams showing the labyrinth's design, along with hundreds of corpses with hollow eyes impaled on obsidian blades. These corpses whisper a warning. Abateum is lost, do not open the gate, Synchronous is death. This revelation suggests the labyrinth isn't merely a training tool, but connected to something far more sinister from before the cataclysm, a mysterious event that reshaped the world. The labyrinth's most terrifying form appears during the Judicium, the Academy's final test. Beneath a dome on Salavagus Island, this encounters a version of the labyrinth guarded by remnants, living waves of obsidian shards that consume anyone they catch. Here, the labyrinth becomes a literal matter of life and death, revealing the ultimate truth about the hierarchy. Those at the top will sacrifice anyone below them to maintain their power. Through this evolving symbol, Islington explores how systems of control operate on multiple levels, from the visible structures that shape daily life to the hidden foundations that support them, often built on forgotten violence and sacrifice. One of the novel's most vivid sequences occurs during the Festival of Yovan, when Viss attends a Naumachia, a massive staged naval battle in Katen's arena. This spectacle serves as a microcosm of how the hierarchy maintains control through regulated violence and entertainment. The Naumachia is a breathtaking display of the Republic's power and wealth. An enormous arena has been filled with salt water to create an artificial lake where full-size ships battle for the entertainment of thousands. The engineering required staggers Viss. The water funneled from the harbor, the ships built, all for mere entertainment. Yet beneath this impressive facade lies brutal reality. The combatants are mostly convicted criminals fighting for the slim chance of pardon. Many will die in the battle, while others who surrender will face the sappers. When Viss questions how this squares with birthright, the law protecting citizens from death, Equa dismissively explains that the fighter's armor is conditionally imbued to remove them from battle after sufficient damage, though she callously admits many will die anyway. The Naumachia represents how the hierarchy channels violence into controlled outlets that reinforce rather than threaten its power. By turning execution into entertainment, the Republic normalizes cruelty while providing catharsis for the audience. The spectator's bloodlust is satisfied within boundaries that pose no danger to the social order. This carefully managed spectacle is shattered when Estevan, leader of the Anguis Levels, interrupts the battle. Using mysterious pre-cataclysm power that nullifies will, he turns the arena into a slaughterhouse, killing thousands of spectators. This attack transforms the Naumachia from a symbol of the Republic's strength into proof of its vulnerability. Through this sequence, Islington examines how societies use spectacle to reinforce power structures and how revolutionary violence aims to expose the system's fundamental brutality. The Naumachia and its disruption force readers to consider the moral implications of entertainment built on suffering, and the ethical complexities of resistance that employ similar violence for different ends. Throughout the novel, questions of identity and authenticity pervade every relationship and institution. In a society where power depends on position rather than character, everyone wears masks, some metaphorical, some literal. Viss himself embodies this theme. Born Prince Diago of Sus, he now lives as Viss Solum, an orphan from Aquiria. When adopted by Ulsascor, he becomes Viss Telemus. After stopping the Anguis attack at the Naumachia, he gains yet another identity, Viss Telemus Catanicus, national hero. Each identity comes with its own expectations and constraints, forcing him to constantly monitor his behavior lest he reveal his true self. This pattern of hidden identities extends throughout the cast. Ulsascor presents himself as Viss's benefactor while using him as a disposable spy. Relucia plays the devoted senator's wife while secretly working with the Anguis rebels. Calidus deliberately underperforms to avoid dangerous advancement. Indal publicly supports his father's military career while privately planning to join religion. Even Amissa, whose friendship seems most genuine, ultimately betrays Viss. The institutions of the Republic similarly maintain facades that mask their true nature. The Academy presents itself as a meritocracy while reinforcing existing power structures. The Senate claims to represent the people's interests while serving the elite. The nomarchia pretends to be entertainment while functioning as public execution. This pervasive deception creates a world where trust becomes nearly impossible. As Viss notes, in a place where everyone wears a mask, how do you know who's truly on your side? His few genuine connections, with Calidus, Ethan, and briefly with Amissa, provide rare moments of authenticity that make their betrayal or loss all the more devastating. Islington uses this theme to explore how oppressive systems corrupt even personal relationships. When survival depends on conformity, authenticity becomes dangerous. Yet paradoxically, these masks also create spaces for resistance. Viss's false identity allows him to navigate the system while working against it. The question becomes whether one can wear a mask so long without becoming the role they play. The Unguis Rebellion presents one of the novel's most morally complex elements. As a resistance movement fighting against the hierarchy's oppression, they initially appear as potential heroes. Yet their methods raise disturbing questions about the ethics of revolutionary violence. Led by Estevan, who calls himself Arturus Melior Leas, the Unguis oppose the fundamental injustice of the will-seeding system. They fight for those at the bottom of the hierarchy, particularly the Octavi, who give will but receive none in return. Their cause seems righteous, until we witness their tactics. At the Namakia, Estevan uses mysterious pre-cataclysm power to slaughter thousands of spectators indiscriminately. When Viss confronts him about killing innocents, Estevan offers a chilling justification. We are what they make us. He argues that inaction equals complicity. By participating in the Republic's institutions, even ordinary citizens bear responsibility for its injustices. This moral calculus is echoed by Relucha when she tells Viss, the decision may have been made by the few, but it's the will of the many that killed your family. Her argument suggests that systems of oppression persist not just through the actions of those at the top, but through the passive acceptance of those below. Yet the Onguis' moral standing is further complicated when Viss discovers they're being manipulated by factions within military. The attack on the Judicium is orchestrated to allow military to take control of the academy from religion. The rebels believe they're fighting for freedom while unwittingly serving one elite faction against another. Through the Unguis, Islington explores the ethical dilemmas of resistance movements. Is violence justified when fighting systemic oppression? Can revolution succeed without becoming corrupted by the very power dynamics it opposes? How does one determine who is truly innocent in a system where everyone participates to varying degrees? These questions have no easy answers in the novel, reflecting their complexity in real-world revolutionary movements. The Unguis serve as a mirror, reflecting both the legitimate grievances that drive resistance and the moral compromises that often accompany it. Physical and psychological scars serve as powerful recurring motifs throughout the novel, symbolizing the cost of power and resistance in the hierarchy. Viss carries literal scars on his back from refusing the Aurora Columnae ritual, marks of torture that represent his rejection of the system. These scars become a point of connection when he discovers Cadmos bears similar marks, though they've reached different conclusions about how to live with their trauma. While Viss remains determined to fight the system, Cadmos has chosen a philosophy of acceptance. We all have them, young master. I chose not to be a victim. Lanistia's empty eye sockets represent another form of scarring, the price paid for involvement with the Academy's secrets. When Viss describes the eyeless corpses in the ruins, she recognizes her own condition reflected in them, saying, "This is a small part of what the Academy took from me. There is always something more to lose." The scarred man who appears during the Judicium embodies how power itself marks those who wield it. His casual violence and disregard for human life suggest that acquiring power requires sacrificing humanity. When he tells Viss to prepare to lose that arm, because none of us get out without scars, he articulates the novel's central truth: power always exacts a price. This theme culminates when Vis loses his left arm after running the labyrinth beneath the dome. This physical loss mirrors his psychological transformation throughout the novel. The idealistic prince who once believed in justice has become someone willing to make increasingly difficult moral compromises to survive and achieve his goals. Through these scars, Islington explores how systems of power mark everyone within them, regardless of position. Those at the bottom bear the visible wounds of oppression, while those who rise often carry invisible but equally profound damage to their moral compass and capacity for empathy. The question becomes whether any power is worth such cost, a question Vis must ultimately answer for himself. Beneath the political machinations lies a deeper mystery involving pre-cataclysm powers and the threat of another world-ending event. This subplot gradually emerges through Vis's discoveries in the ruins and his final experience in the labyrinth beneath the dome. The ruins contain glowing writing, strange diagrams, and eyeless corpses that speak a warning about obiteum and synchronism. Maps show different versions of Solavegus Island, one intact, one destroyed with a hovering sphere in a crater. These discoveries suggest the cataclysm wasn't a natural disaster, but something deliberately caused or prevented using ancient technology. During the Numakia attack, Vis experiences a momentary vision of a vast black pyramid with enormous statues and monstrous waves, when he touches Estevan with a special stylus. Later, Gaius shows him sketches including this same pyramid, suggesting others are aware of these visions. The mystery deepens when Vis runs the labyrinth beneath the dome and encounters a chamber with razor-thin bronze protrusions arranged in a circle. An inscription mentions the way to Lusaeum and Obiteum and the burden of harmony reserved for the one who seals the authors of the war from this world. After experiencing excruciating pain in this chamber, Vis awakens with the word wait carved into his arm, followed by RU, a message he later discovers was sent by Kafirar, who isn't dead but somehow exists in a place called Obiteum. These elements suggest a science fiction subplot beneath the fantasy surface, perhaps involving parallel worlds or ancient technology so advanced it appears magical. Viridius hints at this when he claims Vis must help prevent another cataclysm, implying the Academy's true purpose relates to these ancient powers rather than education. This layer adds cosmic significance to the political conflicts. While factions fight for control of the Republic, they may be unwittingly moving toward another world-ending event. The personal becomes universal, as Vis's choices could affect not just his own fate, but potentially the existence of the world itself. The novel's title encapsulates its central theme. The true power ultimately resides with the many, even in systems designed to concentrate it among the few. This concept operates on multiple levels throughout the narrative. Most literally, the will of the many refers to the energy transferred from lower ranks to higher ones in the hierarchy. The system's genius and its fundamental flaw lie in convincing the majority to voluntarily surrender their power. As Vis's father explained, the hierarchy is built on a fundamental deception. It is not the strong who benefit in their system, no matter what they say. It is the weak. It is the ones willing to do anything, sacrifice anything to rise. On a political level, the phrase speaks to how systems of oppression require mass participation to function. When Relusha tells Vis, "The decision may have been made by the few, but it's the will of the many that killed your family," she highlights how ordinary citizens enable injustice through their compliance. The hierarchy's stability depends not just on those at the top, but on the millions who accept their place within it. Yet the title also contains a hopeful dimension. If power ultimately derives from the many, then the many retain the potential to reclaim it. Vis's immunity to will-draining effects represents this possibility. By refusing to participate in the Aurora Columna, he maintains his full capacity and independence. His example suggests that widespread refusal could potentially collapse the entire system. The novel leaves readers with this tension unresolved. Will the many continue to surrender their power voluntarily, or will they eventually recognize their collective strength? Can meaningful change come from within the system, or does it require its complete dismantling? These questions extend beyond the novel's fictional world to challenge readers about their own participation in systems of power and inequality. At its heart, The Will of the Many is a coming-of-age story set against a backdrop of political intrigue and ancient mystery. Viz's journey from orphaned prince to academy student to potential world saver traces a complex moral evolution as he navigates increasingly difficult choices with no clear right answers. When we first meet Viz, he's living a life of quiet resistance, refusing to cede his will while hiding his true identity. His moral compass seems relatively straightforward. The hierarchy is evil, and he opposes it while trying to survive. Yet as he becomes more deeply embedded in the system, the clarity of this position erodes. His relationship with Ulsa's Corps forces the first compromise, spying on the Academy in exchange for protection. Though initially reluctant, Viz gradually takes pride in his accomplishments within the system he despises. His determination to advance through the Academy classes, originally just a means to fulfill his mission, becomes a personal goal tied to his sense of worth. Relationships further complicate his moral landscape. His friendships with Calidus and Aiden create loyalties that sometimes conflict with his mission. His feelings for Emissa lead him to momentarily forget the gulf between their backgrounds. Even his grudging respect for Viridius challenges his black and white view of the hierarchy's leadership. The Namachia represents a crucial turning point. When Estimon attacks the arena, Viz chooses to stop him despite knowing the Anguis fight against the system that destroyed his family. He cannot accept mass slaughter even in service of a cause he might otherwise support. This decision earns him the title Catanicus and further entangles him with the very regime he once simply opposed. By the novel's end, Viz has become morally complex in ways that mirror the world around him. When offered the choice of which faction to join after graduation, he chooses the censor's office, not because he believes in the hierarchy, but because that's where all the information in the hierarchy flows. He has learned to work within the system while maintaining his own goals, a position both more powerful and more morally ambiguous than simple resistance. This evolution raises profound questions about how individuals should respond to systemic injustice. Is it better to maintain moral purity through total opposition, even if it means sacrificing any real influence? Or is it sometimes necessary to compromise, to work within corrupt systems to change them, even at the risk of being changed oneself? The novel offers no easy answers, instead inviting readers to wrestle with these dilemmas alongside its protagonist. Through Viz's journey, Islington crafts a nuanced exploration of power, resistance, and moral compromise that transcends simple categorizations of heroes and villains. In a world of shifting labyrinths and deceptive appearances, the path to true integrity proves as complex and challenging as the hierarchy itself.